everyone, and welcome to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM, the programme and podcast for anyone interested in teaching, learning, research, policy, or any other area of education. Brought to you weekly by me, Sean Delaney. You can catch up with hundreds of podcasts of previous episodes on seandelaney.com/podcasts. Today's programme may feature one of the most timely and relevant interviews ever aired on the show, because it deals with sustainability of education and the future of our planet. Professor Arjen Walls from Wageningen University in the Netherlands wants learners to contribute to meaningful sustainability in a world where we are constantly encouraged to live lifestyles that are unsustainable. How can we as educators help others live sustainably when we don't really know how to and don't live in that way ourselves, he asks. I had the privilege to hear Professor Arjen Walls speak to teacher educators at the annual conference of the Association for Teacher Education of Europe earlier this year when he delivered a keynote address. In my short time with Professor Walls, I saw how he balanced realism and practicality with ambition and hope. His keynote address was titled Teaching to Sustain and Disrupt: Education in Times of Systemic Global Dysfunction. I began our discussion by asking him to summarise his main message for teacher educators and teachers of Europe.
Education today has become, in many parts of the world, an extension of the economy. We are preparing young people for a world of work, to be flexible workers, to always develop themselves, to be competitive as individuals, and to grow personally. Personal growth has become an industry almost, and if you don't engage in learning, you fall behind. And so we must always run beyond the run. We cannot be where we are or who we are. We must always change, become something else, go other places. A lot of young people are restless. And when we talk about sustainable development, we need to ask a very fundamental question. What is it that we are sustaining in our education? And should we not also disrupt some of the forces in society that make it so difficult for us to live more sustainable lifestyles? So sustainable development and education for sustainable development, it's not just about sustaining development and growth and change all the time. In fact, we must also learn to be who we are, where we are, find our identity, get a sense of place, connect with each other, connect with other species, connect with the physical world around us, and learn to care for that. And if we don't care for that and only care for our careers and to make money and to acquire stuff and to consume goods, which may be good for the conventional economy, I think in the end it's also not good for the economy, but for the conventional economy, but it's not good for people or planet. So learning to live lightly within planetary boundaries, equitably, fairly, healthily, while maintaining a solid foundation of human dignity, human rights, earth rights, access to clean and healthy food, clean and healthy water, clean air. We need to find a way for education to engage with that and not just focus on preparing people for the globalizing economy.
What you've described sounds like something that took a long time to evolve to its present situation. And it's also multifaceted in terms of, you know, promoting consumerism and so on. So where do you begin to get a handle on this problem?
I think begins with awareness about what is going on in the world, what is going on with the planet in terms of the dramatic loss of biodiversity, but also climate change, rising inequity, migration. What's at the root of that? And asking those difficult questions and becoming aware also of the normativity and the hidden curriculum of unsustainability. It is almost taken for granted that we prepare young people for a life of work and consumerism, and nobody is disputing that we need to be entrepreneurial and that we need to be creative and that we need to use diversity, which is all important. But we need to ask that question: what is it that we are strengthening in our world, and what is it that we are silencing or ignoring in our world? And do we need to shift that normativity towards a normativity that is actually conducive to caring, nurturing, sensing, relating, connecting, And how do we begin to do that? I think we can learn a lot from transition thinking and transition theory, where we need to establish niches in schools, where schools get more freedom to develop a localized curriculum that connects the young people to these existential issues that will affect them, that will affect their children in a meaningful way, that we get space for investigating local issues in their global context, because we must not forget that these local issues are often manifestations of global issues, so that we get to cross boundaries between past and present and future, but also between local and global, that we also get to link school and community, that we do not just focus on that what can be measured in our schools and that it can be counted, but that we also pay attention to the things that really matter a lot but cannot be measured or counted. And this has to do with things like empathy, compassion, changing perspectives, values-based processes, where we also look at the value of things in terms of value for the ecology, for social, cultural parts of life, that we not just value monetary things or material things. And if we do have material things, that we learn to care for those things and see that they too have a history. It starts with very simple things sometimes. You know, if you go to a conference like the one that we are here in Sweden, you can have paper cups, and these paper cups that we just had for coffee, you could, at the beginning of a meeting, you could already have a session where everybody has their own paper cup and we start using arts to express something on that cup by drawing and talking about your drawing and your cup. You put your name on the cup, and this cup, this paper cup, becomes your cup in a way, and you kind of develop a liking for that cup because it's something of you in that cup. So you connect with that cup and you're not so likely to throw it away. You're likely to keep it for the conference. It's a little thing, but sometimes it's small things that speak to large issues.
But even if we take that one small one, okay, so if I have coffee in the cup, I'll need to rinse it out before I use it again later. So I'm trying to balance, is it better to be using water to rinse out that cup, or to just take another cup the next time?
Yeah, so this is exactly what I think is an interesting dilemma to discuss. The key point, I think, is that these kinds of questions, is paper a paper cup better than plastic or a ceramic cup, from a sustainability point of view? The question here is then, okay, where do we ask that question? If we ask that question in a place where water is short in supply, and access to water is difficult, then the rinsing of the cup might be difficult and not desirable. For in Gävle in Sweden, where even though there is a drought this summer, it's an extreme summer, there's plenty of fresh water all around us. And the water issue is not as big an issue as it is in, say, sub-Saharan Africa. So the question of the paper cup, what happens to the paper cup when you throw it away? Does it go to, is it an incinerator or landfill, or does it go to, is it recycled as paper? And does it re-enter the system in a circular way? Some places it does and others it doesn't. So that too makes a difference. Here, do you have a system for taking care of that cup in a good way? If you don't, then throwing it away is maybe more problematic. So the point here, I think, is that we need to always ask the question and explore all the dimensions of that question in terms of energy use, in terms of pollution, in terms of people involved in the whole chain of that cup. Where was it made? How was it transported? What were the conditions of the people in which the people were working on that cup? Where did the profit go of that cup? Did it go to smallholder forestry people, or did it go to big companies and their shareholders? It is about economy, it's about ecology, it's about ethics. And the key point about learning for sustainability is to bring in all those aspects and to make a call. You do need to make a call in the end. If we ask this question in Gävle, what is the best answer for Gävle here in Sweden? And recognizing that that answer will be different in other places, it's highly contextual in that sense. But if there's not underneath a willingness to ask that question or a concern about the environment, about the social and the physical environment, about future generations, then nobody will even care about that question. So it has to do in the end a lot with values and ethics as well.
And raising awareness.
And raising awareness. And to add to that, we've learned from environmental education the early years that if you just focus on understanding and awareness, and people learn that it's very complicated and complex and somewhat overwhelming, it can lead to apathy and powerlessness. So you need to connect awareness with action and with examples of change. And engaging young people, and not just young people, intergenerationally engaging people in the question, how can we live more lightly, more sustainably, given where we are now and given what we know today? And how can we continuously recalibrate and look for better ways? Because we care about the future and we care about not just humans, also about other species. These are kind of fundamental values that we do not all have. And that some people have, and some indigenous people have had for a long time, and maybe we all have had it at one time, but we've kind of lost it. So how do we reclaim that, and how can we create learning spaces that invite such values, that breathe sustainability without having definitive answers, but always the desire to look for answers?
So in their work, what would you like to see a teacher, whether at primary level or secondary level, what would you like to see them doing that would contribute towards teaching to sustain and disrupt?
In part, it is in the teachers themselves and their qualities, their curiosity, their willingness to go outside of borders and to leave the classroom and to care themselves about the future, to recognize as critical beings that if we don't reflect on values and the directions that we are in a way being forced to, then you're not a critical teacher, then you're just becoming part of a system that reproduces unsustainability. So critical thinking is a key component of teachers, and in their education should also become a part, using values and ethics and asking moral judgment in the classroom. That's something teachers need to be able to do and be prepared for. But there's one other element. I don't think we should shift the responsibility for doing this entirely to the teachers. The schools, the policies should also create space for this and have trust in the abilities and capacities of teachers to do this. There's a lack of trust, I think, in teachers being able to teach and to be able to create a creative learning environment. In some ways, many teachers have become workers in a system where accountability has become so important that nobody dares to take risk anymore. They are judged on the performance of their students on tests oftentimes, and that is deadly for this type of education that I'm talking about here. So it is a matter of changing the structures, giving space for experimenting in classrooms, having trust in teachers' capacities, and then also in their education and preparation, engage in activities that show how this type of experiential, discovery-based, investigative learning can happen, using the local environment as a starting point of teaching and learning.
I don't think that teachers are the main people, but I'm kind of conscious that they are the audience for this program, and maybe we'll talk about some of the other parties that need to be involved as well. But if we go back to the teachers for a moment, you gave a concrete example this morning of critical sustainability investigations. Could you say a little bit about that idea, which might actually inform teachers of something that they can do at a practical level?
Yeah, it is an example that shows the multifacetedness of sustainability, and it also shows that we need to transcend subject matter areas, that we cannot start with disciplinary questions. But the example this morning comes from the popular American, I think, TV show called CSI, where there's a lot of forensic investigations into murder murders that take place in the community. This is about a different CSI, critical sustainability investigations indeed. And the idea here is that you take, you could have taken a paper cup, but in this case the example was about an old cell phone, old smartphones, we could say now. Where you would ask students in your classroom, let's say it's, 13, 14 or 15-year-olds, I'm not sure what grade that would be in Ireland, and you ask them to look at home for old cell phones and bring them to school the next day, for instance. And usually everybody has an old cell phone at home from their parents or their sister or brother or their own, and they will find two or three. And they bring them to school, and if you have 25 in a classroom, you might have, 60 or so old phones, and you put them in a heap in front of the classroom. And then you divide the class in groups of four or five, and you ask every group to come forward and to pick one of the cell phones. And that's their cell phone for the next day or 2 days. You can make it as long as you want. And you give them a few startup questions. One is, okay, take the cell phone apart. Do it in a safe way, and write down and investigate what kind of materials are in this phone, what kind of metals are in the phone, what's it made of, basically. And you dissect it in that way, and you ask the question with that, where does each of these materials that you come up with come from, what part of the world? And then you can go a little further, okay, how is this material extracted from the world, from the earth? And then you can go even further, like, okay, who's doing that? And how is it done? And what kind of impact does it have on the local environment, on, say, water quality or biodiversity or workers' environments and minings, in mines, for instance? So you from that starting phone, where you maybe find 80 to sometimes more different kinds of materials, and you discover that the whole world is in your cell phone, basically, and that the phone really connects with environment, with ethics, with ecology, with economics. Why can these phones that are so high-tech be so cheap? And why is it that every 2 years I need to get a new one? You know, these are all questions that are relevant. And then it's not just, like I said, it's not just about understanding about complexity and the awareness. It's also about making change. It's not about rejecting cell phones or the technology and saying, oh, we shouldn't be using it, because that won't happen. It's there. But how does it affect, also affect your life? That's another important question. How important is the phone to you? How do you use it? How much time do you spend on it? That is also a very important question about the social, psychological aspects of using the technology, which can be distractive. It makes it hard to concentrate. So to also investigate that element, that's another subject area that comes in. And that last question, okay, how then can we use a smartphone to make the world healthier, more sustainable? That is the design question and the change question. So they could start, some might think about designing apps for sensing, monitoring air quality, or monitoring energy use at home or in the community, or they could start thinking about redesigning the phone itself, like you have Fairphone. They have a different philosophy of how to design phones so that they're easily repaired, that it's fair metals, and it is actually bringing profit to those who are connected to the actual making of the phone, not those speculating on the value of the phone and of the market. So then you get a whole, just starting with, and with the, I think with the paper cup, you could do a similar thing. What's in it? Where does it come from? Why do we use this paper cup in our lives? Are there alternatives? Similar questions. Phone is maybe a little bit more complex, but you bring in chemistry, you bring in biology, you bring in geography, social studies, economics. It's all in your phone. You bring in the local and how it affects your life, the psychology behind it, how we give information to our phones and cookies that we accept, and how the phone is in some ways determining our future, and we're no longer in control of our future. All these questions come to the surface, and you learn lots of capacities, skills doing that, changing perspectives, thinking in an interdisciplinary way, asking critical questions about yourself, about how the world works. There's ethical questions in there too, moral dilemmas. So it's a very rich way, but as a teacher, you need to be able to find that educational opportunity in the things, the everyday life things that we use as a starting point. And in this case, we took an object, a phone, but you could also go outside and ask students to take with their phone pictures of things that bother them in their neighborhood. And they can each, in small groups, take two pictures they need to discuss what's bothering them in their neighborhood. And they come back, and then they have maybe five groups, 10 things that bother these groups. And they you make a gallery walk around these pictures, and you let them explain, why does that bother you? And then after, maybe we can cluster some of these issues. And then once you cluster, okay, let's pick one together that we want to work on in the coming days. Is it really that there is no place where we can maybe play football? Or is it that there's really a lot of plastic in the local river? Or is it, something that bothers them? Okay, and then how are we going to create that space for football? Who are the stakeholders in this? What do we need to do to make this possible? And learn what's working with you, what's working against you. What information do you need? What kind of experts should we ask questions to? So this boundary crossing that I was talking around with the world of work, the world of governance, the world of civil society, and making the school kind of the center of these critical sustainability investigations, where you also need to learn how to interview people, understand the history of the place. Everything comes in play. And there are some countries where there's more room for localized experimental learning. Like in Finland, there's more space for localized curricula. And Finland does also quite well in international tests, which I find interesting. So you can also learn the basics, as they say. Of course, we can have a conversation about what are the basics. So that's kind of an idea of how you could do this.
And are they what you described this morning as alternative pedagogies? Are they examples of them?
Yeah, I think, of course, in education, science, alternative pedagogies have been around for a long time, starting with maybe John Dewey. So for many people in the audience, it's not so alternative, maybe. But this idea of experiential learning, embodied learning, place-based learning, discovery learning, problem-based or oriented learning, they're not new ideas per se, but still we find in most schools that the more transmissive ways of teaching and learning are still dominant. And what is new maybe is the urgency for people to begin to engage with these global challenges to make sure that we still have an earth that we can inhabit in the centuries to come. So the urgency for alternative pedagogies is rising. And in some ways, we're running out of time. And this, I don't want to be doom and gloom here, but the time to begin to overturn these processes that are going very rapid right now, accelerating, and to find another way of doing things, that time is running out. And there is a risk that when we have more urgent global issues and less time, that we may end up becoming eco-totalitarian regimes, where those in power say, oh, we must really do something, and we are actually going to force people to leave the valley because we need that dam, or we're going to force people to move because we need those wind turbines. And this is happening in China. They're very fast in responding in transitioning, closing coal-burning facilities rapidly, renewables rapidly. But there's the question of democracy too then. Do we do this in a co-creative, participatory, democratic way where people feel connected, committed, engaged, intrinsically motivated? Or does it become an eco-totalitarian society where that might be ecologically sustainable, but where not many people are very happy, to put it bluntly?
And if you were to change direction now and to speak to policymakers, what can they do to contribute towards sustainability and disruption?
Well, in part it is giving space, and having faith and trust in teachers and in schools, putting less emphasis on managerialism, efficiency, cost and more emphasis on freedom to learn and to co-create these localized curricula, which doesn't mean that there need not be any accountability. The accountability lies in the contributions the school makes to the community, to the children, and there will be ways of assessing that, more competence-based forms of assessment, portfolios, assessments, peer-to-peer assessment, more in a formative way, that it stimulates learning rather than in a summative way, to rank and to perform and from a performative point of view. So the shift in assessment is also needed. So policy should allow for these spaces to emerge, and I think it's very important that we abandon the testing that we are doing in many schools. It's killing the educational environment, and it's making people unhappy. People, teachers are stressed, school managers are stressed, parents are unhappy about the schools of their children. Children are unhappy. A lot of young people in Holland, where I live most of the time, a lot of young people feel that they're being shortchanged, they're not being prepared for the future that's coming. And a lot of what they do is irrelevant. So they're, in a way, making their own curriculum outside of schools, which is where they learn a lot more, which is ironic in a way. So the educational environment and the educational policies should have more, like I said, more space for autonomy, self-determination, more trust in the capacities of teachers, and find alternative ways of assessing what quality really is.
And that was Professor Arjen Walls from Wageningen University in the Netherlands. I recorded the interview at the Association for Teacher Education of Europe annual conference in Gävle, Sweden, in August 2018. That brings this week's Inside Education to a close. My own book about teaching, Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have, is published by Routledge and available from several online stores. Podcasts of previous episodes are available at seandelaney.com/podcasts. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney saying goodbye. Thank you for listening.